This is an Irreverent podcast. Check out irreverent.fm for shows from all our friends.
1 Corinthians warned you about the women with a loud mouth, and this podcast is just that. Here at the Speaking in Church podcast, we talk all about the regular people and the things that regularly happen to them in the evangelical church. It's a podcast about change, it's a podcast about seeking moral high ground, and it's a podcast for people who are just trying to deconstruct on the safe side. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts, and if you want to be a guest, yes, you, regular person, you can be a guest on the Speaking in Church podcast. If you want to come on, just let us know.
Hello and welcome to Exvangelical. I'm your host, Blake Chastain. In this episode, I talk to Kristen Peterson, author of the book Unruly Souls, The Digital Activism of Muslim and Christian Feminists. You'll learn more about her in a bit when we discuss her book that looks at the role social media has in challenging the still dominant narratives of religion. Now, if you've listened to this show for a long while, you know that I'm aware of the pitfalls of exvangelical, post-evangelical, or deconstruction-oriented spaces online. I don't make any claim that they're perfect, but their function as a counterpublic remains critical in a culture where white Christian nationalism is ascendant and the amount of political and financial resources available to white evangelical institutions outstrip online upstarts by multiple orders of magnitude. That's what Kristen's book examines, and that's why these things matter. This podcast and my publication, The Post-Evangelical Post, are just one example. If you value my work, please consider supporting it with a subscription to the Post-Evangelical Post at postevangelicalpost.com. You can subscribe at $4, $6, or $8 a month, and I donate 25% of net revenue from subscriptions to the Religious Exemption Accountability Project and White Homework. The subscription will get you ad-free podcast feeds, exclusive writing, Discord access, and more. You can also subscribe for free, and you can rate and review the podcast wherever you listen to it. All right, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to Exvangelical. My guest today is Professor Kristen Peterson. She is Assistant Professor of Media Studies at Boston College and author of Unruly Souls, The Digital Activism of Muslim and Christian Feminists. Professor Peterson, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Thank you for coming on. Thank you for reaching out and for writing a very interesting book. I'm really excited to talk to you about it. How we usually start the show is just to learn a little bit about you as the guest, especially your exposure and exposure to and experience with religion. In your introduction, you mentioned that you were raised Catholic, but also exposed to some elements of evangelical purity culture. And it felt like that sentence was doing a lot of work. And I was hoping we could start by sort of unpacking that and learning a little bit about your own experiences in sort of religious spaces. And eventually we'll get to what drew you to this particular work.
Yeah, great. So yes, so raised Catholic, still practicing Catholic. But I went to public school growing up, all the way through high school. I did go to a Catholic university. And so when I was in high school, my kind of intersection with evangelical purity culture, I would say, came about because I was involved with a youth group in high school. I think it's called Arise. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it was a group where we would meet like before school and they would have like singing and preaching and things like that. And I was initially drawn to it because I enjoyed the music and found a connection to that. And then when I was, when I was in college, was more involved in my Catholic faith and was definitely exposed to more of a social justice approach to Catholicism. The university I went to was run by Dominican sisters and was really inspired by kind of their passion for social justice and bringing a lot of these issues into the world, right? So I did a lot of like service projects and work in Chicago. I went to school outside of Chicago. But I also was exposed to purity culture in college. I had this unique experience where I had a friend who was Pentecostal, and she had invited me one night to go to her church for like a service, a youth service. And it turned out that it was actually a purity culture event, right? So it was the pastor was giving a sermon all about purity culture. And I think it was, I don't know if it was True Love Waits. I remember we had like a pledge that we signed that was something about being worth the wait.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
So it was, and I didn't really know that this was what I was getting into. So that was a really kind of formative experience in a lot of ways. I would say one is exposed me to this idea of purity culture, but two, it would expose me to a different experience of religion and experience of religious worship being more of the ecstatic worship, you know, speaking in tongues and things like that, that I was had not been experienced before. And that was really, in that moment, really, really inspired me to like learn more. You know, this is such a different experience than I've had of religion. So that was partly inspired my interest in doing more work with religious studies. But yeah, so that was one way that I intersected with purity culture was through the youth group in my high school, through this experience in college. And then also I was given a purity ring at one point. And, you know, so I wasn't so much inundated in the culture, but I had exposure to it. I would also say like going to a public high school, I mean, we got general sexual education, but there was still this kind of focus on like, don't have sex because you're going to get AIDS, you're going to die, you're going to, you know, all right. These things. So it was a different approach, but it still was kind of this thing of like sex was like this bad thing that you shouldn't be doing. So I carried a lot of that stuff with me, and that did kind of inspire and form my connections in terms of in the book. But yeah, so that's kind of my experience. And then, like I said, I was, in terms of my own personal faith, I found this connection to kind of bringing social justice activism and this work for, you know, work among the marginalized, work for equality in college, in, you know, the services, and also in various, you know, service work, justice projects that I was involved in. And then I did do a year of volunteering after college with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. So that also kind of influenced me in a lot of ways. So now I would say that I'm kind of to the point where I really feel my faith is, I mean, obviously there's a lot of institutional concerns and with any religious institution, but I sort of center my faith on this idea of Jesus being among the marginalized, this work for justice, equality, this kind of radical love within the gospel message. That's where I would sort of position my faith now. But yes, there's obviously going to be, with any institution, there's issues and concerns that are going to come up.
Sure. That's very interesting. I have a couple of things that I want to tease out from what you mentioned.
Sure.
I actually just found some echoes in my own experience. Not, I wasn't raised Catholic, but when I moved from small town Indiana to the suburbs of Chicago, that one of the parts of the sort of culture shift of that was just there were a lot more Catholics. And I also went to a public school through K through 12 and elected to go to a you know, Christian college. But one of the things that was present in our youth group were a lot of Catholic kids that, you know, our peers that would come to Protestant youth groups.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just curious, was that something that was an experience for you and a number of other folks that you knew that might have gone to Mass on Sunday, but then on Wednesday would go to youth groups or things like that for those other types of religious connections? Because I feel like that's just this aspect of some areas that it's another sort of entry point for evangelical influence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think the issue is that Catholic Church, you know, still does struggle to how are we getting the youth involved? And I think there's this idea that, well, like they're doing all this work with young people, the evangelicals. So, you know, there's no harm, you know, and I feel like my parents felt that too. It was kind of like, well, there's no harm in these things because they're Christian, you know, it can't be that bad. And even I was just in conversation with people at my current parish, and they were talking about starting a youth group, which I think is excellent. But there was a discussion of like bringing in like a more non-denominational youth group. And I think partly it's just because there's so many resources, the Catholic faith. I mean, there's more and more being built up, but there's less resources that are centered in the Catholic tradition. So I do think there is, you know, the evangelicals just have so much material to draw from.
Yes.
And I think there's just this assumption like, oh, there's no harm. But, you know, I mean, I do have memories of people saying things that were very anti-Catholic, you know, saying Catholics weren't Christian. And my partner talked about, you know, his brother having an experience of like wearing a Notre Dame shirt to a youth group and people saying like, what's that? Like Notre Dame's like a terrible place, you know? So there is a lot of anti-Catholicism that still exists in those spaces, but I think you're right. I think there's just less resources. And so, and there's sort of an idea of like, well, there's no harm in, you know, sending kids to these other, you know, other spaces to kind of get more, you know, supplemental materials. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that, I mean, that sort of speaks to institutions and the availability of media, right?
Right.
And like yes. They just have spent over 100 years developing these media.
Exactly. No, totally. Yeah. There's a long tradition of that. They've really sophisticated, you know, in terms of, you know, just look at like music is one example, right? Just, I mean, so many Catholic churches use, you know, evangelical music because it's just a lot better, you know.
And widely available. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The other aspect that this is more me speaking out of my ignorance
sure.
is just as far as like I'm aware of the sort of the academic lineage or history of Jesuit colleges and things like that, but I'm not as familiar with those colleges that are founded by the Dominican order.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. So I was a little curious about what sort of things were emphasized at those types of institutions.
Sure.
And you also mentioned that you also worked with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, but that is certainly a, you know, a distinction that if you, again, I'm not a Catholic, so I don't have, like, I have that sort of innate knowledge of what it means to be raised evangelical and Protestant, but I don't. So this is me just being a little bit curious about how those things began to develop your sense and orientation towards faith, especially as you're going through adolescence and developing your own relation to these things.
Yeah. So I think that's a great question. So there's different there's different orders within Catholicism, and mostly those are founded by different figures. So you have like, you know, St. Ignatius is the person who founded the Jesuits, right? Dominic founds the Dominicans, right? Francis, the Franciscans, right? So on. And so there's different, they're kind of like different flavors, I guess you would say, and they have different focus on different, they call them charisms or different like special talents and gifts within those communities. And so there's around those different branches, you have priests and monks and nuns within those communities and sisters and brothers, and they're all different, but there's different just sort of focus and emphasis. So the Jesuits have a big focus on education is really important. So that's why you have so many Jesuit schools. You have a focus on kind of discernment, vocation, those ideas. And St. Ignatius really focused a lot on, you know, kind of this meditation and this idea of like daily examining your daily life and meditating on that. The Dominicans have a focus on preaching. They're called the Order of Preachers. Hmm. But preaching, not necessarily just in terms of, you know, speaking at church, but also in terms of like preaching with your life. So how you serve, how you do good works in the world. And so there's Dominican sisters and Dominican friars and priests, friars being priests. And so the school I went to, which is Dominican University, they were run by sisters. Mm-hmm. So I think that has an influence, more of a feminine influence. And really was a, you know, emphasis on, I would say, obviously education, but really this focuses on pursuing truth. So this focus on education and seeking truth, but also on compassionate service. So kind of bringing those two things together. So there was a really big emphasis on that. And the other thing with the university, even now, is there's a huge emphasis on serving the marginalized. And so the school right now is considered a Hispanic serving institution. So it's like, I think about 70% Latino right now. And so there's a big emphasis on working with marginalized students, working with students who are undocumented. So that's a big focus, doing a lot of social justice projects. So yeah, so that would be, I'm not sure if that exactly answers your question, but thinking about how there's different focuses, but there's an overall obvious idea of Catholicism. And then within, it's kind of like different approaches, different flavors. Are you more interested in education? And even some of the orders are only focused on, you know, monks that live in monasteries and pray all the time? Or is it focused on being in the world, serving the poor? Is it focused on education? Is it focused on healthcare? So there's different focus in that way.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that extra detail just about, because again, this show is sort of narrowly focused often on evangelicalism, but there's such variety to religious experience that it's wonderful to hear those extra details. What drew you towards media studies as an area of focus? Your book is about the digital activism that mm-hmm. plays out on social media. But even before we get to the book itself, what was it about media studies that drew you? And part of me wants to make, you know, vague associations to that, like McLuhan was a practicing Catholic and things like that. However, to me, media studies is fascinating. I love looking at it, and I'm curious what drew you to the topic. It's very large and obviously very significant in today's day and age.
Yeah. Well, I can maybe answer it in two ways. One way would be just to say that I feel like it's a part of everyday life. I mean, you can't mm-hmm. live your life without media, and it plays a huge role in how people understand their lives, make sense of the world, you know, the way that people, and I've just been in, you know, interested in that. I mean, how people engage with media as part of their daily lives and as part of their faith as well. And then maybe a longer way or more pragmatic way was that I started off doing religious studies, and I love religion. I love studying religion, but religious studies was not really the theoretical approach that I wanted to, how I wanted to think about it, if that makes sense. So I discovered that it was a lot of the conversations were more about, you know, what we're studying, what religion is, how we define religion. And I was more just wanting to like talk to people, look at what they're doing, look at how they're using media, how they're making meaning. And I wasn't so much interested in like sitting around and reading a lot of theoretical articles. So for me, I was just like, this isn't quite my jam. I'd like to go more into the media studies approach.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where I can actually like talk to people, look at what people are doing. Yeah. So that was more of like a practical thing. I was just like, this isn't quite exactly fits with my disposition, but I found media studies to be a field that I just felt really at home in.
Right. So to use the religious terms, you're more interested in like the praxis.
Exactly. Exactly.
But the how you saw that as playing out through media because of so much of our life is
right. And there is a field of lived religion, right? You know, and a lot of that comes out of more sociology, anthropology than religious studies. But there is definitely that aspect of religion, of religious studies. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely fascinating. In another life, I may have pursued that same sort of track, but then similar to you, I saw a number of friends trying to engage in religious studies, and it's a very small market. It's a very tough academic market to be in.
There is that aspect as well. It's a very difficult market to be in.
Yeah. That, I mean, broadly speaking, the humanities, you know, there's a lot of commiseration on social media about the overall humanities academic markets and the realities of that mm-hmm. profession. What drew you sort of to as part of essentially covering religious experience through media? What was it that drew you to the topic of sort of dissenting religious people? The term you use is unruly souls. And your book certainly it covers a number of different expressions of that. There are folks like myself who are former evangelicals who use terms like ex-evangelical or deconstruction or what have you. Then you also talk about the Black Christian experience, which is very unique in America and has its own needs and people that are exploring what that entails, as well as those in the Muslim community. So that's a broad, and I want to explore that in a little bit, but what drew you to how these people that were sort of using social media to critique their own religious upbringing or the institutions they participated in? What drew you to that as a topic?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've always kind of been interested in people who kind of stand at the margins of religious identity. So I've always been interested in like people whose experiences are, you know, marginalized. Like I've done work on Black Muslims, converts to Islam. I've done work on, you know, interested in like newer religious movements and how they exist within the US context. So I kind of had that interest. And then I started to notice these really fascinating projects. And what I was really drawn to was the fact that people weren't just, yes, like obviously there's this storyline of people, young people leaving religion. But what I was interested in, like the people who are leaving, but are imagining religion and faith in a different way, or thinking about spirituality in a different way. And that was really what I wanted to look at, was people who were maybe they were leaving their religion, maybe they were imagining something new, but how people were, you know, building up something new and weren't just simply tearing everything down, but kind of thinking about things differently. And really just the ways that people within these two traditions that have very, as I say, kind of very traditional ideas around sexuality, gender roles, how people were trying to work within and pull from elements of the tradition and try to kind of bring back, resuscitate this focus on social justice and equality to build and create new ideas of these religions. So that rather than say, you know, oh, well, Christianity is so traditional, or, you know, Islam is so restrictive, but thinking about like, how can we imagine this faith and celebrate the beauty and the equality that's at the root of these traditions, kind of bring that back and eliminate the problems that have been brought in by power and institution. But yeah, so that would be kind of the main way of thinking about how these individuals were not trying to just completely leave religion and were kind of apathetic, but more how they were trying to create something new.
Yeah. And I mean, through my own work, that part of it has been just using the fact that you're critiquing it means that you took it pretty damn seriously. Let's start by looking at the sort of the commonalities of these groups and then branch into what makes these different communities, or there's the media term counterpublic is sort of how I'm thinking about a lot of these spaces, which I believe it's, there was a book, Redeem All, that also talked about this.
I know Corinna very well. Yeah. It's a great book.
Yeah. It was that book that I learned that counterpublic term from, which I think fits these communities well. But let's start looking, what were some of the commonalities that you found amongst these Muslim and Christian dissenting groups, and then what also, and then eventually we'll work towards what makes them distinct. But what did you see across the board?
I think the critique of modesty, purity culture would be kind of first and foremost, this focus on purity, modesty, piety for women, especially as really kind of becoming kind of essential to maintaining the faith, to maintaining kind of the purity of the community. Mm-hmm. And so the pressure that gets put on certain individuals to adhere to those standards, but also the dismissal of those who are sort of deemed, because of who they are, because of their skin color, their sexuality, are sort of deemed as not pure at all. So I found that to be very similar, and kind of the anxiety around that. So I talk about how there's similar kind of object lessons, you know, that women who have sex before marriage are like a dirty, you know, a chewed up piece of gum or a flower with no petals. And within Islam, it's the same thing of like women who don't wear the hijab are like an uncovered lollipop with flies all around them, right? So this kind of way of sort of objectifying women and turning them into and kind of, you know, using these ideas of like disgust. So that's one of the main points that's very similar. And then talking about how within those communities, individuals talk about, well, even though you tell us like we have to be these perfect, pure, absolutely, you know, modest, you know, be these perfect representations of the faith, but we're still facing harassment and abuse within these communities. So there's this like kind of hypocrisy there where it's like, you're kind of making us do this. And then in the end, when we're harassed and abused, we're still being blamed for that. Right. So there is similar kind of conversations happening there. And then also just this, the abuse and harassment within these communities has kind of came to a head around the same time. So you had very similar movements around Church Too, Mosque Me Too, that were happening at the same time. And then you obviously have issues of homophobia that comes into play, kind of related to purity culture. And then issues of anti-Blackness, I think specifically in terms of racism. So this idea that certain individuals are less holy because of their race, because of their skin color. And that's pretty similar in both contexts as well. So you have a lot of young people also who are, you know, coming of age, engaging with, you know, activist projects around Me Too, around Black Lives Matter, around gay rights, trans rights. And they're finding ways to bring those things into the context of their faith as well. And I also think there's just a lot of intersection. I get at a little bit in the conclusion about how young people, you know, are very aware of the fact that there isn't just one issue, that there's this larger institutional structures that are creating these problems. So that, especially I think coming out of the Trump administration, so issues of like targeting Muslim immigrants is not just an issue for Muslims, it's an issue for other people as well. So yeah, so that would be the main, those are the three kind of points of connection. But I think the purity culture is the key area that it builds on.
And one of the ways that you illuminate a number of these things is by also talking, since it is media and it is social media and new media I know they don't seem that, many of them don't seem that new anymore, but as far as how the various media that we use, because I'm just sort of staking my own participation in this space as both a participant and observer of them. Mm-hmm. Within these various media, how do the different platforms that are used, the different services, mm-hmm. whether it's a podcast like this versus a short form place like Twitter and a visual place like Instagram, and now increasingly TikTok, which has just come out of nowhere to dominate the entire space,
exactly,
in just the space of a couple of years, how do these different platforms shape and contribute to the types of conversations that are allowed there?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's a bit of what I try to get at, because ultimately I'm coming from a media studies perspective. So that's really what I wanted to focus on and foreground. And I think that's key. So if you're thinking of Twitter, what I look at in that chapter is I think about the role of text and textual mm-hmm. spaces within the evangelical community, and talk about how purity teachings are reinforced through these spaces, through books, I Kiss Dating Goodbye and these texts, right? Mm-hmm. And looking at the space of Twitter is really this important space for them to counteract through text, right? To use the language of this culture to, as I talk about, to kind of to present a different ideas, different understandings of sexuality. So, and I think it's really powerful in a lot of the tweets, how people really are using, talking about this deep shame, but then turning this around and really celebrating who they are and what they're created. And I feel like it's an important kind of ritual space that they're doing this work. And then, so that's kind of thinking about the textual space and what that allows for, and how, and also Twitter allows for the fact that you can have this larger conversation. So you can have a hashtag and you can follow that conversation. So a lot of people may not post to that, but may read and feel supported just through that process of following that conversation. So I think about the humor and the ability within text. And then with images, I think there's, you know, especially Instagram and the kind of influencer community, there's such a focus on beauty and this particular kind of visual aesthetic that gets promoted. And so I look in that chapter at how different women are kind of trying to counteract that dominant visual image of a pious Muslim woman, which is really focused on the image, right? Whereas in Christianity, there's a lot of these texts within Islam, there's a real focus on this like perfect Muslim woman looks a certain way. And so I look at that in that chapter and think about, you know, Instagram is really the space of beauty and comfort. And so how the women try to play into and meet the visual expectations of Instagram, because it's an algorithmic space. You can't just post ugly pictures, right? You have to post something that's going to work within the algorithm. And I think the women in the case I'm looking at are pretty effective actually at playing with and playing by the rules, but allowing for different critiques to get into their work. And
then Before you move on to podcasts, could mm-hmm. you elaborate on that sense of play? Because you do mention that throughout your text of play being an element of mm-hmm. of how people interact in digital spaces in particular.
For sure. Yeah. I think that play and humor are really key to a lot of these projects. But I think there's this idea that those who are marginalized, in order to kind of get their voice heard, there's a certain sense that you have to kind of be creative, be playful about it. So that you can't just be sort of offering a critique, offering a counterpoint, and people are just going to turn you away and say you're just, you know, you're just being you know, you're just complaining and who cares? And so I think there's a sense of like trying to, you know, bring forward a critique through humor, through playfulness as a way to kind of bring this idea forward, and people might accept it and not quite always realize that this is also very biting critique. So I'm jumping ahead, but I talk about this with the music video chapter where I talk about Mona Hader's work and how she's this hip hop artist, and how in a lot of her work, like she has this one song called Dog, where it's very funny, but it's also extremely biting and critical of men who are abusive within Muslim community. So I think that's one way that it can be helpful. And I think there's just like this idea of like people kind of leaning into the labels and things that they've been assigned and sort of saying like, well, if you're going to say that I'm like, for example, going back to the images, one of the women is sort of a fat activist in terms of her posts that she does and her fashion. And so she's like saying, well, if you're going to say that I'm like fat and I take up too much space, then I'm going to do that. Like, I'm going to take up space. Like, I'm going to, you know, play into that. And so I think there's in a lot of these cases, there's this use of humor and play as a way for people who are sort of saying like, well, if you're going to say that I'm that, well, I'm going to be that. And I'm going to show you how fabulous I am while doing that.
Yeah. And you bring in, please help me with the term, the decolonial, and what is the term?
The decolonial gaze. Mimicry or?
Yes.
Exactly.
The sense of mimicry because decolonialism is very important for people of color who have been formed in predominantly white led religious spaces and also governments and nations. But that was also a very interesting piece of language that sort of speaks to what can be done in these spaces.
Exactly. So that goes back to, again, Mona Hader's work, another video she has called Barbarian, this idea that she starts the video off and says, like, if you're civilized, then I'd rather say savage. So this kind of idea of like, well, if this is what it means to be civilized, well, I don't want to be that. Like, I don't want, you know. And so it's kind of this idea of saying like, well, if you're going to continue to say that I'm a barbarian, that I'm exotic, but I'm this orientalist stereotypes, then I'm going to embrace that. I'm going to celebrate that. And I'm going to do it by showing you that actually your civilization is not, you know, I'm going to point to the problems and the hypocrisies within those spaces. So yeah, so this is kind of the playfulness and some of these tactics that I'm looking at.
1 Corinthians warned you about the women with a loud mouth, and this podcast is just that. Here at the Speaking in Church podcast, we talk all about the regular people and the things that regularly happen to them in the evangelical church. It's a podcast about change, it's a podcast about seeking moral high ground, and it's a podcast for people who are just trying to deconstruct on the safe side. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts, and if you want to be a guest, yes, you, regular person, you can be a guest on the Speaking in Church podcast. If you want to come on, just let us know.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
And I did cut you off before we... I did... I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I didn't... mean to cut you off or lead you towards another space. You were also going to talk about podcasts and
So I was kind of going on, and it's probably getting a bit boring, but yes, podcasts. So for the podcast chapter, and this is one that, you know, I'd love to chat with you more about, but to think about how podcasts are this really unique medium because they allow for these long conversations, right? So if you're thinking about faith, you're moving beyond sort of like, okay, this is the doctrine, but you're sort of having the space of like, let's talk and let's dialogue and let's think about what faith is, what it can be. And so in that chapter, I talk about Exvangelical and some other emerging podcasts among, you know, evangelicals, former evangelicals. And then I look at Truth's Table podcast, which is hosted by three Black Christian women. And they do just really fascinating work to focus on the theology and to really kind of rebuild a sense of Christianity that centers on Black Christian women's experiences. And so thinking about how that could only really happen within this podcast space, because you have to have the space where there's a lot of time, openness, and this kind of safe community that can be created in that space. So that's the podcasting chapter. And then the last one I talked a bit is thinking about music videos. And I also kind of think about like hip hop as a medium and how there's like this layering that's possible within hip hop music, and specifically looking at Muslim American experience and how for a lot of individuals, they're kind of exist in this third culture where they're kind of in between. And so how the ability to kind of play and layer style and lyrics and music within these videos is a way for them to basically express this kind of in-betweenness and sort of say, especially for Muslim Americans, there's this sense that they are really kind of caught between these binaries of like, you have to always be kind of proving that you're a good Muslim. And so for a lot of these individuals, they're kind of like, I don't want to do that anymore. Like, I just want to be who I am.
Right.
And create material for myself, for my community, and not be responding to this pressure that I have to be a certain, you know, a certain thing.
Yeah. I'm certain that that is a very, very difficult burden to be under, especially like we're a bit removed from it now, just chronologically, but those post 9/11 years were very anti-Muslim, and that trauma doesn't go away.
Yeah. And there's a generational thing too going on here, because a lot of these individuals were maybe even born, you know, really post 9/11 or before, around that same time. And so their experience is very different. And their parents' generation most likely was like, well, we have to be responding, being a good Muslim, all these things. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think a lot of the younger people are sort of like, we're done doing that, you know? And you can look at the media representation and you can see like a movement from, at first you have like sort of the good Muslim who's like helping the like FBI and CIA on Homeland or something, right? And then you have kind of like, oh, the Muslim character in a sitcom or something. And now you have things like Rami, which, and We Are Lady Parts, and some of these really great representations that are just like about young people who happen to be Muslim, who are dealing with their lives. And Islam is a part of their identity, but it's just one part of who they are. And it's not responding to terrorist tropes and these things.
Yeah. And with your focus on video, with regard to music videos, I think that sort of parlays into the space we're in now, where TikTok and now Instagram is trying to mimic TikTok and get that same sort of level of engagement and stickiness, to use their industry terms for just how persistent people use it. I mean, it's certainly a very engaging platform, TikTok, but with that space, like, and with the emergence of video that can incorporate text, can incorporate green screens, like a number of these things that are very easy to bring multimedia production down to a very, very accessible level. How do you see that sort of just sort of pontificating or thinking about the future of these sorts of spaces? My one comment to my own question is that it's been very interesting to see a hashtag like Xvangelical jump from platform to platform.
Yeah, and that's true.
Xvangelical now has 1 billion impressions on TikTok, and Ex-Mormon has 5 billion. And like, you know, like all of these crazy or just wild numbers. And I'm just curious, as a person who studies this in the academic field, where do you see this shift from text to still photos to video? What is your impression about how this sort of sense of play, or however we're sort of relating to these things, what are your thoughts about the way it sort of seems to be going right now?
No, it's a great question. So this semester I'm teaching a class, Religious Expression in the Digital Age, and I haven't taught it since before the pandemic. And it's so fascinating because my students are doing case studies and they're almost all doing something on TikTok. It's all different though. And there's all these spaces that I'm like completely unaware of on TikTok. Like, you're talking about the ex-Mormon movement. There's a lot of like Orthodox Jewish influencers on there. Another student is working on ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. So much of this, right? And so it's become a space where my students are like exposed to all of these different religious experiences that they were unexposed to before. So that's fascinating because it's popping up on their page. I think there's quite a few things going on. And I mean, I think one thing is the, like you mentioned, the kind of layering and the playfulness and the ability for people to access these spaces and to, you know, comment on other things, right? It's very, it's kind of like this, is a word mimemic, right? Sort of like a meme, right? This idea that you can kind of always be sort of building on the work of others. I think there's a lot of potential in that in terms of critique. And like you said, the accessibility that people are able to do this work. And then the algorithm is the other thing, because it's like I was saying, you know, 4 years ago, my students would not know a single thing, I'm sure, about ex-Mormons and ex-Jehovah's Witnesses and Orthodox Jewish women, because where would they be getting this material from? They wouldn't be getting it, right? You'd have to seek that out. And so now, because of the algorithms, people are being exposed to this. I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's helping these ideas to spread more. It's interesting that it's almost all ex-whatever, right?
Yeah, certainly.
I'm not sure what's going on with that.
The only ones that I've seen that on TikTok in particular, I see things like progressive clergy as a hashtag, or sometimes deconstruction. Like that's just sort of become this catch-all term. And there's certainly a lot of dialogue and sort of counter dialogue because evangelicals will use the term deconstruction to vilify people that deconstruct them.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of, it's this point of contention between two very different publics that they never actually talk. They just talk about each other.
Yeah. Well, and so then I think it's like, it's obviously an important space. There's obviously people out there who need to get these ideas out and need to express themselves in this way and in relationship to religion. So there's clearly a need for this. But then I guess the only thing, I mean, there's a few concerns I have. I mean, one, I feel like it's so ephemeral that it's like people see these things and it's like, does it really have, what does it do? You know, how much of an effect does it have? Because it's an algorithm, you know, I mean, this is another issue we've been dealing with, is like, well, who's seeing this, right? You know, where's it going? Who's determining this, right? Is it that these stories are spreading more because they're more extreme or more emotional? Is that why the X things are spreading? Because there's obvious, like people have like a fascination with religious extremism, you know, that could be it too. But I do just, and then I wonder like what will be the offline effect of these movements? Like, is this gonna, like, are these former movements gonna have the effect of something like Exvangelical, right? That was created through Facebook, right? Through Facebook group.
Well, I started a Facebook group initially as like a Patreon benefit, and then ended up opening it up in 2017. But I started the podcast in June of 2016.
Yeah.
Or July rather. It was to coincide with the 2016 Republican National Convention. So that's when I started. And then by the fall, I had been started to use the hashtag, and then it started to become more popular first on Twitter. And that's, and then it sort of gained steam and became more of a colloquialism what have you.
Right.
But I mean, some people, there's not even agreement around terms, just like in, again, speaking to the X element of this, where we carry these things forward, like Protestants, you know, they split all the time. They have all sorts of permutations. And so some people don't like ex-evangelical or say ex-evangelical or post-evangelical. I mean, my own newsletter is called the Post-Evangelical Post because I'm just embracing the punniness of it all.
The playfulness of it. Yeah, exactly.
All my ideas start as puns. So, because I'm a language person, not an image person.
Right. Yeah. And so I guess my question is, and we don't know, but I just wonder, like, is there going to be this larger conversation happening around these movements, or are they just going to be existing in this one space? And will they be sort of forgotten in a day or two? You know, potentially they may be, right? And so I guess that's kind of my question of, like, clearly this seems to be something that people are desiring and need to use to express themselves. But how will this, what's kind of the next step in these spaces? Yeah.
Yeah, that's very much what I'm exploring as I work on my own book, because I think visibility is the first, has been sort of the first step that people have left evangelicalism for decades. It's just now there's more visibility to it. But speaking with regard to institutions are resilient and retain a lot of power. And so even though people expect, you know, the number of Christians in America to collapse, there's a, you know, a recent Pew study that just came out about that, that they expect Christians will no longer be the majority in America within 50 years. That's a significant change, but we'll see how that actually changes the institutions. And
no, you're exactly right. Yeah.
And whether we can create alternate institutions, whether right. we can agree enough on something to create something mm-hmm. that resembles an institution or a radical realignment of society. Like, mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah, no, exactly.
I'm sorry, I'm leaving some space because I felt like we were talking over a little bit and I wanted you
I was just thinking of the fact we were talking about institutions don't disappear. And I was just thinking of there's a lot of religious movements that have very few members remaining, but still exist as institutions. I was just thinking Christian Science, for example, or Scientology, some of these religious institutions have even less than a million members and they still are powerful institutions in different ways.
Absolutely. Yeah. When you become an institution, it takes on its own life in a lot of ways. And to your point of the ephemerality of these mm-hmm. these spaces, the fact that it is related through media, often, you know, unfollowing somebody or leaving a Facebook group is a less, there's less friction there than there is mm-hmm. to lose your entire social support network. And I mean, sometimes it's just a matter of oversaturation. I remember someone I knew that participated in these spaces for a while, and then, you know, their attention was drawn elsewhere. When they joined another service like TikTok, somehow they started getting served this content again. It's like there was no social graph that came over, you know, so how did this happen?
They just knew the algorithms.
The algorithms, those all-seeing eyes. Yes.
Yeah.
So I think it's such a fascinating space, and it's great to know that there are media studies people exploring these things with sincerity and interest, mm-hmm. because clearly it's been valuable and meaningful for me to participate and help, you know, share these conversations mm-hmm. like this, but to know that there are people who are observing it and trying to learn what's happening is also, to me, encouraging, especially for the ones. I know that there are folks that have other relationships to these spaces, but many of them that I participate in mm-hmm. are default public. Twitter's mm-hmm. default public. Mm-hmm. Podcasts, you're obviously publishing something. So to see this critical attention is valuable. Is it, when you study these things, do you have both quantitative and qualitative methods? Mm-hmm. what sort of tools are brought to bear?
There's definitely some methodological challenges, I would say, to studying these spaces. I mean, mostly just the quantity of material can be difficult. I'm more of a qualitative scholar, so I don't do a lot of, you know, any sort of statistical analysis of these spaces. I'm more interested in talking with people and looking at the content. But there's definitely challenges because you have a lot of content. So mm-hmm. actually studying podcasts is really a challenge because there's so much content out there, right? So you're listening to hours and hours and hours of content. And I also feel like when you study podcasts, you have to really, it's not just listening to the content, it's actually sort of seeping yourself into the culture that's part of the show. So for example, listening to Truth's Table, I could just listen to it and write everything down, but you really have to get a sense of the personality of each of the people that host the show and the types of things that they each talk about and their dynamic with each other. So I just think that's a key part of podcasts as well, that you can't just, like I said, you can't just listen or you can't just write, you know, get a transcript of the episodes. So there's a lot. That's a really challenge to study because I did an article where I looked at different podcasts that talked about grief. And so I was just listening to one episode of each podcast, and it's hard to do that because then you're not getting the sense of the overall focus of the show, right? And what the show does. So I was able to a bit, cause I've talked about The Liturgist and I've listened to that one, and I talked about WTF And I listened to that too. But for some of them, I was just kind of going blind because I was like, I don't have time to listen to an entire podcast, you know, all their episodes. So that's a challenge. Studying Twitter is a challenge because there's so much content as well. There's different tools you can use, but yeah. So looking at images and videos, I enjoy that. I'm more of a visual type of person. So I like kind of analyzing those spaces. But yes, you definitely get into the struggle of like how you study when you have so much content, how you study when things are ephemeral, like with TikTok, with Instagram stories. You know, so much is on Instagram stories now, but it's really hard to study those. You have to literally every day be going on there and taking screenshots. It's a lot to manage. And then there's also the privacy issues, I think. Like you were mentioning, it is public, but you also don't really want to be like this weird stalker who's like writing all this stuff about
right
people,
yeah yeah you know?
And also you want to protect people's sense of, even though they're posting in a public space, like for the Twitter discussions, I don't think people are posting on these spaces and they want this to be written about, you know, 10 years from now or whatever. So I tried to, with that chapter, I adjusted people's language so you couldn't like search exactly and find who wrote what tweets. Except for the people that were kind of the leaders in the movement and people I talked to. But I feel like that's important just because you wrote something like once, like several years ago on a Twitter thread. Is it something that you really want everybody to know you did and what you said? I think it's more the essence of what people are saying is what matters. So there's those issues as well. But I think the main issue for me is just the amount of content.
Can be a lot. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is, it's surprising and it's just, it is an incredible amount. And it seems that, you know, having, I feel like an old hand, even though I've only been doing this for 6 years and but then at the same time, I think of folks who've been in similar spaces for 20 years, you know, and what must they think of us as upstarts, you know?
Yeah, like, exactly.
But people continue to use these platforms in order to explore how they relate to faith and how those things change over time. And the participatory culture, I think, is the other.
Yeah.
You know, the term for those things and the way in which people participate either long-term or for a season. It's absolutely fascinating. And I'm thankful that there are books like yours out there that are examining these things and, again, taking them seriously and to the degree of care that you put into how you sourced things. And it's very fascinating. And I know that you mentioned this show and the book, and I feel like almost like it's a little self-serving or like I've been really happy to talk about these things with you and dive in a little bit to what you covered. Is there any other sort of area of, before we close out, I know we sort of talked about the way these platforms are changing as far as, you know, more of an emphasis on video through the influence of TikTok, looking more at the way in which you see the content that people are making. Do you foresee any other sort of changes in these spaces or in other unrelated spaces happening right now that you think are going to be worth keeping a close eye on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right that there's more of a shift to the ephemeral nature of TikTok and entering Instagram more into that, right? More algorithmic. I think that's the key shift is more shifting to more algorithms, and people are less seeking out specific communities and they're kind of being receiving the content. Because if you look at like the purity culture chapter, that happened in 2016. So that was a while ago. So I think there's less of a need for those specific communities that people are seeking and more moving away from textual spaces. But then I think there's still a desire for longer form discussions. So while you have kind of the ephemeral algorithmic spaces, I think people are still seeking out the podcast spaces, video spaces still. I mean, we didn't talk a lot about YouTube, but still having those spaces as well. And yeah, I mean, I've, like I said, I think those as we talked about already, the way that TikTok has become kind of the space for all this like X, Y, and Z stuff is quite interesting. And but also there's a lot of like stuff on like Bible readings and interpretations and more traditional stuff as well. So yes, I think it's moving more in that direction. The other thing that I've grown more interested in is the alongside you have these kind of critiques of institutional religions, you also have a growing focus on spiritual but not religious stuff. So a lot of stuff with wellness culture and, you know, new age things. I think that stuff's quite fascinating because it's kind of perennial. It sort of comes back. You know, my students will talk about manifesting and I'm like, and they really will, like in class, they'll say something about how you have to like somebody in my social media class said something about how you have to like manifest who you want to be on social media and like in your profile in order to become that. And I was like, wow, that is really, you know, and she said this like completely seriously. And I was like, wow, that's fascinating, you know? And this language goes back to like Mary Baker Eddy in like the 1800s like manifesting. Yeah. So these ideas are like not new, but they keep coming back, right? So that part I'm quite interested in, like these, and specifically a lot of women are involved in these spaces. So I've grown interested in that, like how these women are kind of claiming authority through playing into these ideas of like new age, astrology, wellness culture, this kind of new thought, prosperity kind of ideas. Yeah. So that's a bit of, there's some things that I see, but I don't know. I'm a little bit down on TikTok in some ways. I find it so overwhelming to me, but I think there's kind of two sides. You have this like fast paced ephemeral disappears. And then you have the slowness of podcasts and long videos and things like that. So it's a fascinating time to be in.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, maybe it's a product of my age or just burning out of certain things, but I find myself, yes, I'm going to write a newsletter. I'm going
to, yes, the newsletter things. That's the other thing. Yeah.
I'm going to have a long conversation with someone that I get to share. And then we can talk about that as an artifact in and of itself.
Exactly. Like, no, I was telling my students the other day, I really honestly find the way that TikTok loops to be very like jarring. And I find the way that the sound is always so imbalanced. I find that very, like all of it, I just find very, like, it just is very jarring. And I can't spend much time on there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, it is sort of a learning curve or just like, just a exposure type.
Yeah.
Almost more than anything else. Like a lot of times I find Instagram to be that way too, because for me, it's the scrolling down versus scrolling across with the stories. And, you know, I'm not a very adept Instagram user, but TikTok is sort of, I've forced myself to learn just out of curiosity. And all those things that you said are true. Like every video is different and you don't know what you're going to get and it's complete lottery. Mm-hmm. So, and the content is endless. So it's hard to know what you're going to get when you open that app, but it does seem to be where the zeitgeist is, at least, at least for now.
Exactly.
Well, Kristen, it's been wonderful to talk to you about your book and about your experiences. Where can people find the book?
Sure.
Where can they find you on any of these platforms?
Yeah. So the book is available. I mean, it's available everywhere, but if you want to get it through the press, it's Rutgers University Press, Unruly Souls. And I mean, it's on all the other platforms you can get books. And I have a website, which is my name, Kristen M. Peterson. I'm also on Twitter at Chrissy PD, so KRISSYPETEY. And so feel free to follow me, say hello. And thank you, Blake, so much for this. I really appreciate your thoughtful questions and reading through the book so carefully, and it's been a really fun conversation.
Likewise, thank you very much for coming on. It's been great.
1 Corinthians warned you about the women with a loud mouth, and this podcast is just that. Here at the Speaking in Church podcast, we talk all about the regular people and the things that regularly happen to them in the evangelical church. It's a podcast about change. It's a podcast about seeking moral high ground. And it's a podcast for people who are just trying to deconstruct on the safe side. You can listen wherever you get your podcast. And if you want to be a guest, yes, you, regular person, you can be a guest on the Speaking in Church podcast. If you want to come on, just let us know.